We had been breaking your balls all night with like every pairing that you brought us.
Like, yeah, because that's like the thing that you do.
Tani would try and come up with whatever the dumbest thing that she could. She's like, the nose is detecting aromas of tarmac, and the palate is detecting hints of ennui and open verse.
She's a pain in the ass, and so are you. So, like, forgive me for not believing you when you immediately mentioned that, but I corrected myself, as any self-respecting service professional would.
Yeah, the best part was that we said raisins, and you didn't believe me. And then she said, no, it really tastes like raisins. And you snatched the glass out of my hand, took a sip of it.
Yeah.
In front of all of your other customers, by the way. And then immediately, like I told this last night, and my son was very interested in this point in the story. You immediately turned like Bruce Wayne saw the bat signal. And my son's like, is Jamie? I'm like, no, he's not Batman. Jamie's not even remotely like Batman.
I love the idea that even for a moment, he thought that I was Batman.
Just for a fleeting second. You disappear into the kitchen, send one of your servers out, who says, Jamie, he said we're going to take care of this. The two glasses disappear. No one tells us anything for like 3 minutes, except that I hear you shouting in the kitchen, hey, who wants to try some wine that's gone bad? And then you come back out with a fresh bottle and present it to us. And I kind of preferred it when it tasted like raisins, is the long and short of it.
I am actually, this is unusual, I'm having trouble remembering what wine that was.
Well, I mean, maybe you just serve people wine that's gone bad like a whole bunch of times, and you don't have any, you can't sift out one experience from another.
Oh, God. The idea that that's conceivably true just piqued my anxiety to, like, panic level. All right, cats and kittens, welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. My name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. I am the movie guy.
And we are pairing wine with movies. We're hopefully exploring the synesthesia between the two in a way that doesn't make you all want to gouge your eyes out. Today, We are focusing on what movie, Scott?
We're watching First Cow. Kelly Reichardt's 2020 low-key masterpiece, First Cow.
Low-key? Is it? I guess the movie could be described as low-key, but it is not low-key a masterpiece.
The movie is low-key. Right. It is straight up a masterpiece. The movie itself is low-key.
Yes.
To be clear, thank you for critiquing my modifier.
I'm here for you, Poppy. So the descriptors that Scott gave me for this pairing were sweet, earthy, gradual, intimate, and subdued.
Indeed. And I stand by all of those.
Yeah, I think that is a really great description of this movie. It is all of those things.
Gradual, by the way, is just movie people polite speak for slow.
You a couple of days ago, you described it as a stately pace, and that's another coded, like, this is slow.
Her films are all stately paced. That is part of the Kelly Reichardt aesthetic. I did warn our guests who were watching it with us last night. I will probably reference them again, so I should be clear. We are vaccinated. Our guests were vaccinated. We trust their behavior, even though they're vaccinated. They're not assholes going out to bars and stadiums, and it was weird having people in my house. But we had people over, they drank some of the wine with us, and we watched the movie together. But I did warn them. I warned them that gradual is just code for slow.
So, given those words, I regrettably did not choose a wine from Oregon. And I'm probably going to express my dismay with myself a number of times during this episode. Despite the fact that I think, spoilers, this wine paired really, really well, this movie is so rooted in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon, and in that sense of place, that the idea of not pairing an Oregon wine is obnoxious. But I paired Corte Gardoni's Pradica bottling. This is their Bartolino Superior. It's a blend predominantly of Corvina with also Rondinella and Sangiovese.
Sangiovese!
When we put this season together, I wrote out a pairing justification for this wine. What I said was, earthy foods go with fruity wines, so let's give that a try. This wine has a lot of sweet fruit notes to go with the sweet tone of the flick. It's light-bodied while still taking time to open and develop. I stand by most of what I said. The one thing that I was not expecting on this wine, because this is my first experience with this vintage, was the Brettanomyces, which is a strain of yeast that is very frequently desirable in beer, but thought of as kind of the enemy in wine, although there's definitely an argument to be made that it's present in a lot of really classic wines, but it's the, like when I say barnyard or in its most extreme form, like Band-Aid, that's Brettanomyces or Brett. And this wine certainly has a lot of that on it, especially when you first open it. It kind of like takes over the fruit tones. And for me, that was one of the things that made this pairing work really well. It starts off super duper, like profoundly earthy, and then ends up a little bit lighter, easier, and more fruity.
It's funny you mentioned that that was your first experience with this bottling, because this was actually my first Kelly Reichardt movie. She had been on my radar for a long time as this like icon of the American independent scene, and I just never watched any of them. And then First Cow made a fairly big splash, or would have made a fairly big splash last year if the movie didn't come out in 2020. And I watched it and then went deep on her entire filmography, and I actually watched her second feature, Old Joy, right before we recorded this. So I've now seen all of her feature films. But yeah, First Cow. It's great. So this movie was, so it's directed by Kelly Reichardt. She also edited the movie, and she co-wrote it with Jonathan Raymond, who is a longtime collaborator of hers. And the movie is extremely loosely based on Raymond's first novel called The Half-Life. Funny thing about the adaptation is that it doesn't have a cow in it, and there's no milk. The novel takes place over like 4 decades, and it has Cookie Figowitz, and it has a character named King Lou, but King Lou in the movie is a amalgamation of that King Lou and another character that Cookie like has what Raymond calls a homosocial relationship with. But it, you know that line where King Lou is talking about how they're missing out on the beaver oil trade?
Yeah.
That's the plot of the book. Cookie and this other character travel to China and try and start like a global trade route about beaver oil. But then there's also this whole other narrative that's in roughly the modern day where the two bodies are discovered, which is where the movie actually starts.
Oh, wow. So very loosely adapted.
Yeah, Reichardt read the book and wanted to do something with it, but they could never figure out how they condense all of that into a movie, and especially like a movie of the scale that she tries to make. And they kept spitballing and spitballing and spitballing, and then it was Raymond who came up with the idea of like, well, what if we have a cow? Because the cow and the milk being a commodity and how it ties in with trade,
right,
brought in all of the themes and ideas that he had been writing about territorial Oregon in the 1820s. The movie is about two loners in the Oregon Territory in the early 19th century. The characters are Cookie Figowitz, played by John Magaro, and King Lou, played by Orion Lee. They're loners in the Oregon Territory. They become friends through circumstances, and they set out on this low-key criminal enterprise selling deep-fried oily cakes to the trappers at the local fort made from the stolen milk of the titular first cow to come into the region. It played the festival circuit in late 2019, getting great marks at the 57th New York Film Festival, and A24 did the slow rollout, platforming it ready to go wide, and it was supposed to go wide release nationwide on March 6th of 2020, and it was in theaters, you know, for a couple of days, and then the whole world collapsed.
Was there something that happened in March of 2020? Something like,
I mean, I don't know. Isn't it still March of 2020 right now?
It may well be. So did it get like good critical buzz?
The reviews are great. The reviews are terrific, and it was one of the most talked about movies of the first half of 2020. And honestly, like, I don't want to talk about the Oscars except that it's snubbing on literally every category is infuriating to me. And I think the movie might have played better had Nomadland not come out.
You think Nomadland is the thing that stopped this film?
Well, look, like, neither one of them are conventional Oscar movies, okay? But 2020 was a weird year, and like a lot of the big studio things that would have dominated the nominations, like The French Dispatch, the new Wes Anderson movie, or Spielberg's remake of West Side Story, like these things that got punted until 2021, they moved on, and so it left this like vacuum for smaller, more esoteric movies to kind of like fill in and actually run the table in the awards season. And I just have a feeling that, you know, Oscar voters only had room for like one quiet, contemplative, like landscape-driven, observational, behavioral drama.
Right, but can we just like a little bit, just a little something? Like,
yeah.
You said it, and you asked me to keep my eye out for it as I was watching this movie, and I think you're totally right. Like, costuming is the thing that like jumps off the screen, I think. It's so good, and also the way that the costuming talks about character, too, and works yeah. into, like, visual storytelling. I think the best examples are King Lou and also character who I don't think ends up getting a name, but the guy in the green jacket who gets cut in line and who supposedly, yeah, like, probably you're led to believe kills them.
Presumably kills them. Yeah. Spoilers, by the way. Spoilers for how we think the movie probably ends.
Yes. We assume that they are killed in the woods by a guy wearing a green jacket.
But you talk about the costuming. So for me, this is something I mentioned last night. The hats that Cookie and King Lou wear, yep, tell you everything about those characters. Cookie has like a sad boy, downtrodden, defeated hat that kind of slopes around his brow. And King Lou has, I don't know how you would describe that hat. It's like kind of a proto bowler hat almost.
To me, it looked like, and it read with the rest of his costume as like a poor man's top hat. It was a counterpoint to what Toby Jones is wearing, which is the full-on rich person dress.
But yeah, King Lou has a hustler hat. You see him in that hat, like when he shows up again in the bar, and he's in like the all black suit, and he's got that hat on. You're like, oh yeah, this guy, he knows how to work it. Like, he is always looking for an angle.
Cool. So is it time for wine talk now?
I guess time for wine talk now.
I can.
Well, but before we do that, I want to know, what do you think of the movie? Because we haven't really talked about it. Like, what do you think? What is your take?
I love it. I really do. I had to, I think probably largely because of the obnoxious internet electronics age that we live in, I had to stop and rewind a number of times during both of my viewings.
That's frustrating.
Well, for the second viewing, it was because your wife and your house guests were texting me their takes on the wine while I was also drinking the wine and watching the movie.
Boo fucking who, man? Put your phone down. Turn off notifications. This is a movie, Jamie. This is a movie.
We turn off our phones during movies?
We turn off our phones for movies, yeah, all right? You can text all the way through fucking Mandalorian and Baby Yoda. I don't give a shit about that. This is a movie. You turn your phone off.
By the way, I have never come close to watching The Mandalorian, and the Baby Yoda memes are sometimes funny, but I find it just looks stupid. The whole thing from the outside looking in looks dumb.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my
take on
Mandalorian, not having watched it. You probably could have guessed that one of the things that really connects with me is the friendship and like the particular way that King Lou and Cookie become friends. It feels so uneasy to begin with. Like, as an audience member, I didn't feel secure in their, like, friendship and love until they're being hunted down and they hug.
So, like, you didn't feel secure in the friendship until the end of the movie, essentially.
That's correct, yeah.
Wow.
I think there's a bit of, like, visual storytelling that starts, honestly, with King Lou's costume, where, like, he's dressed in all black and he's dressed like a hustler. You know, yeah, like someone who is ready to do what it takes to make it. Like, most of his dialogue is talking about making money and either escaping or the next scheme or this scheme or like whatever have you. So like,
but you thought he might screw Cookie over.
Not that I thought he might screw Cookie over. Because
they do play off that tension at the end of the movie. Again, spoilers, but like when Cookie lays down, like they're on the run, Cookie lays back and King Lou sits next to him, and you know that Cookie is dying from this head wound. He looks at Cookie and he looks at the bag of money in his lap, and he's weighing it. Like he's deciding which is more important to me. The choice to stay, oh man, it's just so beautiful.
It felt to me that in that moment, everything had already been cemented. And so my tension, for me personally, had evaporated, largely because of that hug. Because, like, through it all, he didn't leave. And he could have. And should have. He had the money. And he was in mortal danger. But he came back.
He was waiting for his boy.
And that Cookie was so trusting from the very beginning. And that's why he's always been an outcast.
Well, he's trusting, he's soft, he has, like, more feminine traits. He's gentle. It's pretty clear in the beginning of the movie that he's pretty good at foraging, and he's for shit at trapping, because he doesn't want to hurt any animals. Yeah. And so he just, like, never learned to be good at, like, killing squirrels. And then you're walking along when he's first pairing up with King Lou, and it's just like, yep, here's my trap, let's check it. Squash squirrel. Here's another squash squirrel. And it's just these great traps he's made with, like, big-ass rocks, and Cookie's just watching him. And it's like, oh, these guys can actually pair up. They can complement each other nicely. Cookie can make the food, and King Lou actually has, like, not the killer instinct, but, like, he doesn't have a problem with killing an animal to sustain himself.
Exactly. I think it's a beautiful tale of friendship. And I love how both of them work with one another. And I just think the characters are really well drawn. I love the movie. I think it just warms every part of me, despite being a little bit dour.
I'm glad you liked it. I thought the thing that you would have responded to is the class stuff in it, and the slightly anti-capitalist bent to the movie, which is very, very up your alley.
Oh, yeah. Very much love that. But the thing that I connected to more, and I think it's probably because it's more important to the narrative, is their friendship. Like, this is a very intimate character movie that, while it hates capitalism, and it hates it, like, sort of without qualification, it loves its characters more.
I don't know. I don't know if it hates capitalism, because capitalism is, like... She's a pretty political filmmaker, but she doesn't smother you with the politics in her movies.
No, it's not smother, but like, it's pretty, they fucking die because of capitalism.
But you could also say that they both die because of friendship. King Lu could have survived. But like, they both also have opportunities because of capitalism.
But they wouldn't have been forced into that position had they not been so economically depressed and like forced into the position of theft by the ruling class.
But also their greed, and in particular King Lu's greed, like that's what gets them caught. Cookie wanted to stop after they had that awkward meeting with the proctor. Or with, I keep saying Proctor, with the chief factor and with the captain, where the cow is basically giving up the game by nuzzling up on and getting all up in Cookie's business, which apparently was not scripted. Like, the scene is scripted, but the cow's response was just because they had already done all of the night scenes with John McGarrow and Evie the cow, and they had, like, formed a bond, and so she just kept, like, nuzzling up against him.
That's so great.
You kind of can't imagine the movie without it. Like, no. Otherwise, what is the captain become so suspicious of? But yeah, like, Cookie wanted to bail off at that point, and King Lu got greedy, and he couldn't let it go. Like, it's not just the oppressive system that is denying them opportunities and keeping them in their station, like, class-wise. It's also King Lu's own greed, like, his own desire to ascend and transcend his station.
I don't know. It felt like King Lu was being very pragmatic. Like, he understood what things cost, and he kept saying, like, it's enough to go there, but it's not enough to start. I think King Lu had an understanding of the system, sort of dispassionately, that... Cookie didn't, which is what kept them there. But the read that it was greed is also valid.
Anyway, we don't need to argue about it.
No. I love the movie. I like the friendship bits. I love the like indictment of capitalism. It's super intimate and slow, and you're like totally earthy, stately paced. It's beautiful.
I gave you an excellent description for the film.
You did. So wine.
Wine. Tell me about this wine. This wine that you paired with this film.
This wine is from a producer called Corte Gardoni. Corte Gardoni is situated in the Bardolino area of the Veneto in Italy. So we're talking northeastern Italy. The Bardolino area is starting to try to like subdivide itself in the way that Burgundy does for like more direct and specific, I guess, expressions of terroir. So if you want to get super geeky, this is from the Somma Campagna subregion that's even farther in the southeast area. It's farthest from Lake Garda, which is the like primary climate mitigator in the area. This is the Pratica bottling, and it's the appellation on the label is Bardolino Superiore. The wine is a blend of Corvina, Rondinella, and Sangiovese. It's about
Sangiovese. I can't help myself.
Sangiovese is grown all over Italy. We all kind of know that it's best expressed as a varietal wine in Tuscany, but there's tons of it everywhere, and it can be a good blending companion to sort of add complexity and acidity and all of those things.
Corvina. Why?
What's that?
Why? Just quickly, why?
Why is it a good blending companion?
Why is it a good blending companion?
Because it's a naturally high acid and tannin variety, so it can add those things, as well as earthiness, red fruit, like any of the things that Sangiovese does great in Tuscany, it can add to blends elsewhere.
All right. Got it.
We got this wine from Moore Brothers Wine Merchants. It's imported by Fleet Street and also in other markets by Kermit Lynch. Kermit Lynch is notable because he's one of like the first big name importers and really did a lot to popularize like small farmer driven estates that are focused on sustainability.
Is that what this is? Is this a small farmer driven estate that is focused on sustainability?
It is, in fact, yeah. So it's a product of a winemaking family that's been in the area since the 1600s, but their vineyards were decimated in the 19th century due to phylloxera, which we've discussed previously on this podcast.
Have we?
We have. It's a root louse that decimated vineyards louse. Across the world in the 1800s. So this family had to sell their land.
Oh, we talked about this 2 days ago.
That's correct, yes. And you had trouble remembering, yes.
Well, I'm also trying to help out future me cutting this show together just in case that part ended up being boring in the previous episode. It's just good for a little bit of context.
Good excuses. I know that you just had trouble remembering.
Sometimes the background stuff is dry. You think I'm going to include everything that I said about fucking Kelly Reichardt's filmography?
So they had to sell their land in the 1800s, and Gianni Piccoli purchased a new plot of land in 1971, which is what became the Corte Gardoni estate. They farm sustainably, or what is called in France, lutte raisonnée, which translates roughly to reasoned fight or supervised control, depending on your take.
Those are both pretty aggressive terms.
Yeah, they are. I think they're both terms sort of in response to like the certifications that have arisen around organics and biodynamics. None of this is certified by anybody, but it's just like this is like just a general sustainability thing with no specific benchmarks, so to speak.
Hmm. Okay.
And they make a super yummy wine. I love these wines. They're like less expensive bottling, the Le Fontone. Or Fontane is like $13 and just super damn delicious. And for an extra $6, I think this way overshows. And I think my previous comparison to Beaujolais really stands. You know, it's a light-bodied, red-fruited wine. It's fermented with native yeast, so there's sort of like a broadness to the flavor palette. There's a lot of earth along with a lot of fruitiness that comes out once it's been open for a while. It is medium plus in acidity, so really great with most foods. I had it with some Greek food the other night. That was fantastic. Some souvlaki.
I had it with a side of beef. Side of beef called First Cow. That's what I had this with.
I was about to say, you ate a whole side of beef? That's a lot of beef.
No, I didn't have it with food. Because unlike our listening audience, I don't get food pairing suggestions with these wines. Well, I have a question about something you just said. You said it is made, or it is fermented with native yeast, which lends it broadness.
Yes.
So when you say native yeast, is that the yeast that is native to the area where it is made, or is there like a specific kind of yeast that is native yeast?
So look at your hand right now.
Jamie, I'm not high. Like what are you
to
do?
I'm here? Just demonstrating that like there are yeast cells literally everywhere, including on your hand currently. So if you just put something that has sugar content out on your desk, it'll ferment because there's just yeast there.
This is very unsettling to learn.
And that's what I mean by native yeast. There's yeast that grow that just is naturally on the grapes in the vineyard. And then there's also yeast that lives in the winery, just sort of is there.
So they're not adding yeast when they're fermenting. They're just using the yeast that is already on the grapes when they're plucking them.
Correct. Yeah. It's the difference between putting your grapes in a vat, crushing them, and adding yeast, like a selected commercial strain, or not doing that and just waiting for it to ferment on its own, which it will.
Huh. And that takes longer?
Takes longer. It's also risky because you don't have one yeast that immediately dominates. So you can get off flavors. You can get what are called spoilage yeasts, which make it taste bad. So it's the kind of thing that is usually only done by winemakers who have an awful lot of confidence in sort of the culture of yeast that's growing in and around the winery.
And how does native yeast lead to broadness? And also, what is broadness in a wine?
What I mean is more flavor components. So think about it this way. If I pitch, and when I say pitch, I mean add a selected yeast. That's one variety of yeast. That's a single species and, for lack of a better term, breed of yeast that will produce a set number of flavors. Whereas native yeast are of a large spectrum of different species and varieties. And they'll all start fermenting concurrently. And eventually, by the end of it, one will dominate. because that's sort of just the way it goes. And you'll
but end, you still get all the other little flavor note.
Yeah, the beginning of the fermentation gives you that sort of broadness.
So you're saying, in addition to all of the germs that science has convinced me exist on and in my body at all times, there's also yeast everywhere.
That's correct.
All right. I don't care for this. Look, I'm not an anti-science person. I'm not one of those people. I trust and embrace science. But sometimes I feel like I'm just learning a little bit too much, all right? That I wish we wouldn't pull back the veil so much on the real world that's right in front of my eyes.
I guess that's fair.
Yeast everywhere.
But like, it's not going to change your behavior. You already know that if you leave a strawberry out on your desk, it's going to be bad.
Yes.
And part of that is because of mold, for sure. But the other part is yeast. It'll ferment.
All right. This is very strange. I'm unsettled.
Does it also bother you to know that yeast is, in fact, a fungus?
I mean, that it's a living organism, I think I technically understood that. But when you started describing the difference that there are species of them, now I'm having some trouble with it, honestly.
Oh, we're going to go deep on yeast someday. We're gonna have a big discussion
about it. That's the title of your sex tape right there, buddy.
Going deep on yeast?
Going deep on yeast with Jamie.
That's really fucking gross. Super duper gross.
Your wrestler name would be the yeast infection.
And that's kind of what I've got about this wine. What are your takes on it?
Would you like to hear my notes? Do you want to hear my thoughts?
Yeah.
This might be my favorite wine that we've talked about for this show so far.
Hell yeah.
That is a pretty impressive progression from my first thoughts on the wine, which were it's gross and something is wrong. I texted you how I should be presenting it. All of us, me, my wife, and our guests, all looked at the bottle and we just assumed it was a white wine. To the point where, like, I uncorked it and started pouring it. And as it's coming out, I was like, oh, this is red. And we were all surprised.
Why?
Why? I don't know. The green, maybe the color of the glass, I don't know. Maybe the shape of the bottle. All thought it was a white wine, so we put it in the fridge to chill. and you revealed to me that it should not be served chilled. And that is 100% correct, because it was butt nasty served chilled. Did not care for it. And then you told me that by the time it warmed up, so I was cupping the, what is this part of the glass called? This part?
The bowl.
I was cupping the bowl of the glass with my hands to warm it up, and it started to taste a little bit better, and we all kind of warmed up on it. But yeah, I have notes. I have thoughts. At first, when it was chilled, I thought it was super unpleasantly tart. The finish was really gross. Like, this probably doesn't mean anything, but like sour tannins. Like tannic, but sour and wrong.
Yeah, I think what you're describing...
Extremely unpleasant.
And it's worth noting for everyone out there that, like, when you... That everything tastes most like itself at room temperature. Cold suppresses flavor, and heat enhances it.
So why do we chill certain wines?
Partly because sometimes, like, the phenolics of white wine need to be a little bit suppressed. Also, partly because, like, chilled things just, like, are pleasant
for
us.
Hang on. You gave me a new vocab word. The what need to be suppressed?
Phenolics.
Phenolics.
You're acting like you've never heard this word before, and I know that part of that is you playing dumb, but we've definitely talked about it. It's the bitter compounds in white wine. Tannin is also a phenolic compound, so that, like, astringency. And what I'm getting at here is that you were basically not tasting any of the flavor in the wine, and you were just experiencing acid and tannin. And yeah, that sounds awful.
It was very unpleasant. But by the time it warmed up, I was getting all kinds of shit. I was getting so many notes. I was getting underripe apple, like green apple. I thought it smelled like a bloody steak. I kept coming back to blood, especially I was watching the movie. The wine kept making me think of blood, even though there's nothing about it that tastes, you know, like a fistful of pennies or anything. But I just kept coming back to blood. I was getting black pepper. Jamie will be proud of me. I actually got leather off of this one.
Hell yeah.
I earnestly and sincerely, on my own, watching the movie, I was like, motherfucker, there's leather in this thing. And I had to put it down in my little notes app. Blood orange, chocolate, and strawberry. Like, really good, like, farm fresh, you know, juicy. Not your grocery store strawberries. Your fresh off the vine strawberries.
Yeah.
Or bush.
During, like, in season strawberry.
Yeah, exactly.
But you liked it. But
yeah, I really liked it. I liked it a lot. I liked it so much that I had four glasses of it, like, over the course of 2.5 hours, which is a lot for me when I'm not eating food.
Love that. Yeah, I love this wine. I think it's like, it's light bodied. It's like lowish in tannin, higher in acidity. It's got like really just under 13% alcohol, so super moderate. You know, I really love Beaujolais, and I hate to come back to that as a reference point, but I think it's a thing that a lot of people sort of have had. And I think that this is a great alternative. Your wife texted me vinyl and insulin, which initially made me upset. And then she also texted me like an article about what insulin smells like, because I had never experienced that, not being a medical professional nor a diabetic yet.
Well, give it time, Jamie. You're a young man. There's plenty of time to become a diabetic.
I said yet, motherfucker. We don't need your
commentary. All right, there was Zoom lag. I'm sorry.
So yeah, I think that's all there. The fruit character is mostly for me red fruit, like Bing cherry, raspberry. I love the strawberry note, and maybe that's just because I'm like trying to anchor this to the place, but one of the things that I always remember about Oregon is the strawberries. I don't know if you, have you been to Oregon ever?
I have. I spent a couple of days at the top of Mount Hood for a film festival.
Was it during the summertime?
No, it was snowy as a motherfucker. I was at the Timberline Lodge for the first Overlook Film Festival. But anyway, I'd never left the fucking lodge, and all I ate was like what was in the hotel.
So you never got to experience it, but there's something specific about Mount Hood strawberries. When I first experienced Mount Hood strawberries, I was like frozen in that moment of time, and I can still like go back there and remember that flavor. And it feels like that's in this wine, that really lush in-season, like specific Pacific Northwest strawberry thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's really complex, but at the end, it's easy to drink. Because it's not like structurally difficult in any way. It's lighter in body. Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I think it's super, super yummy.
Yeah. Jamie, should we play our little game?
Yeah, let's play our game.
Now, I've got a theme song. I've been working on
it. Jesus Christ.
We've had a few aborted attempts at a theme song. Here we go. I think this should be short enough that legally it's okay for me to do it. Wine Folly.
Oh my God.
Doesn't have notes for blends. So we can't do Wine Folly, Jamie versus Wine Folly today, because Jamie once again picked a blend or an unconventional wine that does not have a page on Wine Folly. So we return to Vivino.com, and they do have a page for the Corte Gardoni 2018 Pratica, and so it'll be Jamie versus the aggregated user tasting notes of Vivino.com. So Jamie, give me your top five flavor notes that you think the users of Vivino would have listed in their reviews of this wine.
I'm going to clarify that I'm playing this game my way and not your way. I'm telling you the top five that I get.
Why can't you ever just play the game the way it is? Like, nobody fucking shows up to a poker table and says that they're playing Canasta. Like, what are you doing? Just play the game.
F*** you, buddy.
All right, fine. What are your five top flavor notes?
So Bing cherry, raspberry, Mount Hood strawberry, right out the gate. Those are the first things. And then I'm going to go with barnyard / cow manure and wet topsoil.
All right. So to repeat, Jamie's top five were Bing cherry, strawberry, raspberry, barnyard, and wet topsoil. Drum roll, please.
No drum roll.
So Vivino's top five were... Do you want me to give you the categories or like the specific flavors? Because they group it by the top five categories and then break it down based on the flavors within.
I don't know. Whatever sounds good. Whatever
you like.
All right,
so their top five were... Black fruit, specifically blackberry. Earthy notes, specifically stone and cocoa. Spices, like cinnamon. And red fruit, strawberry, raspberry, and cherry. Jamie, I think you've done it. I think you finally succeeded at the game, even though you won't play by the rules.
I didn't get spices as much. Like, I get them, but I don't think it's in the top five for me.
Oh, wait, never mind. No, you didn't. Never mind, you failed. You didn't get cinnamon. Or pepper or licorice. But so manure and topsoil would be in the earthy category.
Yep.
Well, so we'll give you 4 out of 5. We'll say 4 out of 5. Who's counting?
You.
This doesn't matter.
You're counting.
I am keeping no record of this whatsoever. Except that we're recording it. So other things that were noted by Vivino's users, licorice, plum, baking spice, and tobacco were all in their top mentioned flavors.
For sure. I think that the licorice thing speaks to... sort of like a medicinal characteristic to this wine. And that for me is sort of tied up in that family of flavors, the like star anise, tarragon. It's a little maybe Robitussin-y.
A little bit of Robos. I can't say that I place that at all. Even being as suggestible as I am to flavor and olfactory notes, I'm not getting anything.
No medicinal?
Licorice or medicinal.
No Robo?
No, I mean a little bit of Band-Aid, like that's in the medicine cabinet, but.
Got it. It's all super subjective.
Yeah.
And speaking of fucking subjective, I've already said that I think this pairing works.
How well does this pairing work? So you tried to pair something going for like an opposites attract kind of situation, right?
In some ways, and in other ways, like right on, you know, I think the taking a while to open was part of my pairing, as you had mentioned that this movie was
gradual.
And I think that once you get past the like very, very earthy parts of this wine, you get this sort of this very fruity character that I think plays very well against the earthiness of the movie, but also directly agrees with the sweetness of the two main characters' relationship. So it was an opposites pairing in some ways and a direct comparison in others.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that once my wine finally warmed up and you know, it was a coincidence, but that my wine initially was very unpleasant and off-putting, but like it gradually revealed itself to be something that was warmer. Just like the movie is, it's a slow start and it takes like a little while before it gets cooking, not to pun on a character's name, but like until their relationship forms, you don't even know what the hook of the movie is going to be.
You really don't. They don't start making the cakes until what, an hour in?
Almost an hour into the movie. But even then, like when the two of them finally connect and they go off together, you're like, all right, great. The movie is building a relationship. This is something I can get my hooks into. And it continues to take a while to reveal to you what it is. Like first you have that opening shot, which is like a minute long of just like a contemporary cargo ship coming down I think it's supposed to be the Columbia River. And you just watch the entire thing pass by.
Yep.
And it's setting the pace, it's setting the tempo, but it's also thematically important. It's telling you, like, here's commerce. Commerce is coming in. And then we flash back and we get, like, a time travel moment. And you just slowly, slowly, slowly reveal more and more until finally it's, oh, this is a buddy picture. And we build a relationship between these two men. And then, oh, this is actually sort of in the realm of a caper film. Like, they're stealing something and then selling it. Like, there's that underlying tension of, like, crime. It's not a crime movie, but there is a criminal element and, like, genre tension to it.
There is.
But it just takes a while to show you what all of that is and kind of put all of its cards on the table. And in the same way, I found the wine replicated that and matched very nicely to it. Some people have described this film and Kelly Reichardt's whole body of work as austere, which I don't agree with. Like, I think Meek's Cutoff is austere, but like it's austere as a Western. Like it is a Western that is restrained and pulled back, and like it's austere as an example of its genre. Whereas I think the rest of her body of work is much more directly engaging and emotional. She holds back on some things in terms of like narrative, and like she hates the idea of character arc. She doesn't talk about character arcs, but it's still very emotionally engaged and very like direct in what it's talking about and what we're trying to engage with.
Yeah, I don't think it's austere at all. Nor do I think this wine is austere. I think that both of them, like the things that are there are specifically put there, and maybe the volume isn't turned up to 12, but it's also not, like, they're not withholding anything.
Yeah, it gives you that information and that, like, emotional information in different ways. I think she said in one interview that Cookie and King Lou, almost none of their dialogue tells you who they are. It's all in their behaviors and their actions.
Yep. Yeah, I think broadly, beginning to end, the wine and the movie work really well together because of exactly what you described. I also found that I really like this wine, particularly as pairs for the cow milking scenes and also the relationship between Cookie and King Lou. I think that there's that sweetness of relating with someone. And Cookie undeniably has a relationship with the cow.
Yeah, it's the most intimate relationship in the entire movie. He's almost flirting with the cow. I always love that bit where it's after the first time that they've sold the oily cakes and he comes back to milk her the next night. There's some of the few close-ups on him the whole movie. Like, he doesn't get a lot of close-ups in his dialogue scenes with King Lou, but you get these really, really interesting kind of over-the-shoulder close-ups when he's talking with the cow and milking her. We sold some oily cakes from your milk. Everybody loved them. They couldn't get enough of them. Put a little bit of honey and cinnamon. but it was your milk. That's what everyone really loved. Like, oh, as he's squeezing on the teat, like, it's almost inappropriate and gross, but it's so lovely and sincere that you can't snicker at it. Like, it's just beautiful.
He knows how to treat this cow right. For him, it's a relationship with the cow that is also giving him an amount of livelihood. For Chief Factor, it's all about status, and he doesn't give a fuck, like, status and the breeding of the cow. That's why the cow responds to him as opposed to Chief Factor. So yeah, I think it works really well. And not just because I think the wine has like notes of barnyard, but the sweet tones of the fruit notes in the wine and the sweetness of that relationship. And then also the sweetness of the relationship between Cookie and King Lou, I think works really, really well.
See, that's interesting that what you think is good about the pairing is the sweetness and like the how the wine complements the warmth and like the emotions of the movie. Because I had a very specific reaction to one particular scene. And we talked about this last time, that Parasite-La Craventine pairing was the first time for you that it wasn't an abstract. Like, you had, like, a tangible understanding that was achieved by drinking the wine while watching the movie.
Yeah.
And I had that moment with First Cow and with the Prodica. It's the scene where King Lou, he's setting up his traps. It's the first time that he and Cookie are like, they've just had that bar scene where they're meeting up again. And he's setting his traps and he's talking about the land. They have this amazing conversation about how King Lou says everything feels new here because it's been untouched by humans. And Cookie says, nah, I think everything is old here.
I love this conversation that they have.
But he says, history, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but history isn't here yet. Maybe we can be here before it gets here. And this time we can take it on our own terms. As he says that line, like, this is the second or third time I've watched the film, I'm drinking the wine. And at this point, this is probably my third glass. And the tannins have scraped my tongue raw. And it immediately takes me to the two of them on the run and then laying down together and dying. And the tannin just made me think, like, no, man, you are not going to take history on your own terms this time. Like, it's going to wear you down. It's going to grind you into powder. And, like, you're going to get beat down by it. History is going to catch up to you when commerce comes to this area in a new way. And you have this huge barge ship that, I think the implication is, like, the river has been broadened to accommodate these huge shipping containers, yeah. Which is why the soil erosion it's so easy for her to uncover their skeletons. And that all happened to me, like, in that moment, because I heard that line of dialogue while I was drinking this wine, and it was just beating the hell out of my taste buds. Because the tannins.
Yeah, the things that really struck me were the more positive notes, the more hopeful things. This is a movie that, like, it can be read as hopeless in exactly the way that you just described. Because Chief Factor wins. But it's about the intimacy that they shared and the friendship that they had that makes the movie enjoyable in the end and sort of shines a light on the relationships that we have in our own lives and that this is the important thing for me anyway. You know, those relationships are what's important, I think. And that's sort of how this pairing hit me, was these relationships with Cookie and the cow and then Cookie and King Lou. I forget exactly the context. I just wrote down this quote, but they're talking about something and King Lou goes, I believe different things, different places. And I think that probably hits me in a number of ways because of like the way I interact with wine and like the idea of terroir and a sense of place and all of that. And it works with this wine because this wine is so very much an expression of the Bartolino area. It isn't going for anything. They're not shepherding it in a particular direction. They're not using all of the, like, winemaking techniques. It just is what it is.
I guess my question is, like, is that something that you intuitively understand? Like, you drink this and you're like, ah, yes, Bartolino. I'm totally getting notes of Bartolino here. Like, is that a real thing?
I haven't tasted as many Bartolino wines as one would need to be able to specifically identify the core of what Bartolino is. But what I can reliably recognize is technique. So big oak presence, acidification, chaptalization, extraction, like all of these things that are used to manipulate the flavor of a wine in favor of making a product that is palatable to a broad subset. I can see those things. And in the absence of those things, I get a wine that I read as being representative of the area. because I can tell it's absent all of those things that I know are used to cover up the signature of an area.
And where does terroir fall in all of that? We need to talk about this again because I still don't understand it. And also because I think we definitely went long on it in a previous episode and that is all on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, it's, I mean, terroir is fucking abstract.
So terroir is the expression of place in the wine.
Yes.
Right. But what does that mean?
It's kind of hard to quantify, but I'll try. All the factors that go into what a wine tastes like, right?
The chief factors, you might say.
One of them is the grape variety. One is the soil type. One is the climate. And another, which I think is less talked about, but that I would argue is pretty fundamental, is the people. So the grape variety is oftentimes dictated by what grows there the best, which is then dictated by the soil type and the climate, right? And then the soil type and the climate have a further effect on the flavor. So like Pinot Noir grows really well both in Burgundy and in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, but they each have specific things about the soil and the climate that change the character of the finished wine.
And you can tell the difference between these.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't mean you. I mean like one can tell the difference between these.
One can, and also with some reliability I can. And then you have the human factor, which is all the techniques that you apply.
The techniques applied to help express the place.
Right. Or to hinder.
And then the techniques express themselves in the finished product.
That's correct.
All right. I feel like I understand terroir then. That wasn't so difficult. You quantified it.
It's the discussion goes a lot longer than that, but that's the beginning.
No, I think this is it. This is good. This is fine. This is enough.
Yeah, we'll just end it there. This thing that is like a constant conversation in the wine community, we'll just sum it up in a paragraph.
That's fine. We have plenty of opportunities in the future. I don't understand it. I mean, like, you explained it, and I guess I understand it. But then again, like, if I say to somebody that this movie and Kelly Reichardt are great at expressing and creating a sense of place, like, that probably doesn't mean anything to people, right?
To a lot of people, I would think that that would sound pretentious at best and abstract and without basis at worst. Which is the same way that it, like, sounds when I talk about terroir. But I would disagree. I think that this movie in particular does a really great job at giving you a sense of place.
Yeah. She does it in a lot of really smart and extremely economical ways, too. Like, one that I really like is the use of animals. So it's Reichardt's own dog that's in two of her previous movies. But she loves using untrained animals in her films because they behave like real animals. And so there's all kinds of dogs just, like, scrambling around in the background of the shots at the fort in this movie. And it just gives you... Because, like, a trained dog knows how to behave on camera in that they know how to behave. Like, in the way that, like, a disciplined child knows how to behave.
Right.
But they're not actually behaving. They're not, like, acting like an animal. And just seeing real dogs running around, like, and having real animal behavior lends such an authenticity, you feel like you're there. She encourages the crew to bring their dogs to set, and they're just around, and you can feel it, and you can get this sense. It gives you sound, it gives the actors something to respond to. It feels like a real place because there are real living things there. The other way that she expresses place, I'm going to use your term for it, the way that Kelly Reichardt expresses place or suggests place is with the framing. This movie is framed in 4:3 is the aspect ratio, or 1:3:3:1.
And I got to tell you, I wish that you had told me that that was the case before I started, because my first watch, it comes up in 4:3, and I was like frantically going through the menus on my TV, like trying to figure out what the fuck was wrong. And then like 5 minutes later, I Googled it because I was like, this can't be, everything's right. And I was like, okay, it is actually 4:3.
Yeah, it's 4:3. I think this is her second 4:3 movie. Meek's Cutoff is also 4:3. There's benefits to using 4:3 than to using widescreen. Like she said in a really good featurette on the Blu-ray called A Place in This World, She said that close-ups and two shots, especially in a movie about relationships like this one, can be really beautiful in a boxy frame like that. It brings them together. It emphasizes the intimacy. Because it's not that it's narrower, right? You can't think about 4x3 and that it's not wide. It's that it's taller. That's what you're really getting out of it. So you have a, when you frame a close-up, you have more on top and more on the bottom right. in the image, which can lead to close-ups that you don't get the breadth of all the trees to the left and right of him when Cookie's out in that like primordial forest, but you get the height. You get to see more of the background of the image behind him because you're not just looking at this like narrow slice of the image that's like from his forehead to his collarbone. She said that they wanted the framing to suggest the height when they get to the fort. The high walls of the fort are like one of the few visual like landmarks that they have in the movie. And with a taller frame, you get to suggest that height and you get to suggest like kind of how the fort dominates over everything. Let me ask you a question. How, like in the fiction of the movie, how big do you think the fort is, like in terms of population?
I was thinking about this, and especially since you just brought up that height thing. With the height of the fort. Maybe I missed a shot or I was looking down or something, but I never got that establishing shot.
You get like a couple of shots of the wall when Cookie is following the young indigenous girl who's getting milk.
It just didn't impact me in a way. Like, it's not a recognizable establishing shot the way I'm used to in movies. And maybe that's my own like lack of a visual vocabulary, but I felt like the fort was super nebulous, and the specific geography that they were working with, it felt like it was almost like purposefully vague.
Jamie, I give you credit. You're more perceptive to these things than I expected. They suggest more than they show. And I think part of that is probably to conceal like a fairly minimal budget. But like, if you actually think about what you see in the fort, you see a couple of shacks on the outside where some of the, like, you know, the dirty, poor old folks, like poor René Aubergenois, who plays the crusty old man with the raven on his shoulder in his last performance.
Who's like angrily sweeping.
Yeah, exactly. Rage sweeping. So you see a couple of shacks with him out there on the outskirts of the fort. You see the wall a couple of times and you see like one building. And then everything else is in close-ups. And in particular, it's in close-ups on hands. And the way that she suggests the size of the fort and that there's a busyness to it and that there's a lot of activity with people going on is with amazingly subtle and kind of minimalistic sound design that just gives you voices and activity and animals and, you know, tools in the background to give you the sense of like an active place and a lived in place, but also with just the little bits of what you see. So like there's the scene where Cookie buys the boots, right? We've seen a couple of times that his boots have holes in them and his toe is sticking out.
Yep.
And so he trades for some dude and gets boots, and we watch him walk into the fort
and get harassed.
Well, he gets harassed, but before that, what is the shot? What are you actually seeing? It's his feet.
Right.
The whole shot is framed on his feet, tracking him through, like coming into town. You see other bits of activity behind him. You see other people walking around. There's like a fire. There's some like guys just sitting by a wall who then say, I forget the dude's name. That's John Smith's boots or whatever. And then they're mad at him for it. But it stays on his feet. So with that framing, like she gets away with basically just a shot of one actor's feet in the mud and then using sound design and little bits in the background to suggest this whole other world. So it saves on the budget. But it also, it literally roots you in the soil. Like so much of the movie by the framing on feet and framing on hands. Like think how long it is once we jump back into the 19th century, how long it goes before you see Cookie's face.
It's true.
You get whole minutes of just him foraging, his hands interacting with the soil and plucking at mushrooms, and he saves that little orange newt.
I loved that bit. I also loved
I thought you would like that.
Foraging for chanterelles, which is like chanterelles are about to come into season right now, and I'm chomping at the bit for the first ones to come through. By the time of this episode's release, they will be fully in season, and they're like my favorite mushroom. But also so specific, like they grow here in Pennsylvania, but they grow rampantly and extraordinarily well in the Pacific Northwest. Like that's a bit of like the place.
Right.
Can we talk about sound for a minute?
Yeah, let's talk about sound. Because the sound is unreal in that it is so real.
It's super real. It's super naturalistic. It really, like, talk about sense of place. And I think that you already made the point. It really brings you in. And I had my sound cranked up so that I could hear everything as much as possible. And I really fucking enjoyed the hell out of it. A thing that struck me was how little of this movie is scored. It's all just what is around you. I think that the Wine did a really good job of sort of filling the gap of score. It gave me a different, because score gives you tone and it gives you ambiance and it gives you...
And it gives you emotion.
Emotion, yeah. And I thought, maybe it's just because we're doing this obnoxious synesthetic abstraction. I thought that the Wine did a really good job of replacing that part of my experience.
Interesting.
What do you think?
I wouldn't put it in those words exactly, but I think that kind of lines up with what I was feeling. It's like I don't know that I would have had so many notes that were centered around blood. Like, I just kept thinking of blood orange and bloody steak while I was drinking the wine. And even though it's not a violent movie at all, like, the specter of death lingers over it the whole time.
The whole time. Everyone is on the... Everyone except for the captain and Chief Factor is in danger of imminent death.
Yeah. From the get-go. But yeah, this comes down to, like, we're both having different perceptions of the pairing. Like, for you, the pairing is about friendship and relationships and sweetness. And for me, the pairing is about tannin, like, scraping my tongue raw and, you know, and the fatalism of, like, starting the movie with the discovery of the skeletons that we will soon figure out are our two heroes, like, our two best bros for life who will... die, like, basically hand in hand laying in the dirt. So yeah, like, I think the Wine filled that in for me, but it filled in totally different notes. If you want to compare the Wine to the score that is absent, because this is, I think, part of what people like who describe her films as being austere, because she doesn't use a lot of score. She uses score for, like, montages and transitions more than really anything else. But, like, if the Wine is the score, then for you, the Wine is, I don't know, like, a sweet and bubbly, like, high strings, like, not hijinksy, but, like, it's a light and bouncy score. And for me, it's like a horror film score that's underlining, like, the impending sense of doom.
I would say I agree with your characterization broadly, but I would say that for me, this Wine does a good job of sort of like the sweet melancholy score.
All right. I can roll with that.
The sadness of the impending death, but the celebration of the, like, current love. Because it's definitely, it's a love story between these two. Like, they love each other. They're going to, like, set off and start a business together and live their lives together.
Yeah. God, it's such a good movie. I like it more every time I watch it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot more the second time. I'm excited to watch it again.
Yeah, you should watch her other movies. In particular, you should really watch, like, you would love Wendy and Lucy, and you would really like Meek's Cutoff.
Cool. You wanna take it to conclusions? What do you think?
You wanna put a button on it? I feel like I've drawn my conclusions. This Wine was good. I think the pairing is exceptional. Even though we both like the Wine, we both like the movie. We both think the Wine is doing the same. Like, we're in agreement on what the Wine can do and what the Wine is doing, and we both agree what the movie is about. But then our takes on the pairings are in opposite directions,
which I find
fascinating. Well, it's because it's all subjective navel gazing bullshit, and none of this is real.
None of it's real. It's all fake.
Yeah. It's all fake.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think it works. I think the movie's great. I think the Wine's great. My one big complaint with myself here, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, is that I didn't choose a Wine from Oregon. So I'm just going to take this moment for anyone interested to suggest some wines from Oregon that one might enjoy.
Now, would these would be from the Willamette Valley? Is that like that's the big region in Oregon, right? Is that the only major wine region in Oregon?
That's the big famous one. There are a number of others, although I should correct you because anyone from Oregon would be upset with you. It's pronounced Willamette.
Oh, it's Willamette. Willamette, I apologize.
Pronounced Willamette, damn it, is what they would say.
Oregonians have a bit of poetry. In them.
They do, yeah. And I do really like, so there, I have four suggestions, one of which is outside of the Willamette Valley. So first suggestion is Day Wines, D-A-Y, by a woman named Brianne Day. She's got a winery in the Willamette Valley, and she shares her space with a number of other winemakers. But I think her label is super great, and she makes a Pinot Noir from the Johann Vineyard, which is sort of a famed vineyard in the Willamette Valley. And I think that would work beautifully with this movie. A smaller winery called Fossil and Fawn, that's just a single married couple doing sort of everything. Their Pinot Noir would also be great. And then Illihi is another producer. And they, in very hipster fashion, make a wine called 1899 that is produced using only technology that was available in 1899, up to and including putting the wine on the river on a non-motorized boat to get it to Portland.
This is like what, the wine nerd version of like the paleo diet, right?
That's right, yes.
This is like tying both hands behind your back and like try to make food.
It's annoying, but the wine's really, really good, and I think that it would work really well. And then the last wine that I would mention comes from the Columbia Gorge, which is farther north and also borders Washington. The winery is called Hiyu, H-I-Y-U, Wine Farm. It's a project of a former master sommelier named Nate Reddy, and he does a blend that's based on Blaufränkisch that is just fucking killer. It's mad expensive and tough to find, but I think would really work with this movie. And all of these wines sort of share in common the same kind of lack of technique that the Corte Gardoni has. You can tell that it's like people who farm intentionally and use that as the primary mover of the flavor of the wine and not selecting yeast or oak barrels or long extractions or any of that stuff.
Nice. And are these wines that are widely available to people?
They are. The Illihi is probably the easiest to find. Day Wines would be in second place. Fossil and Fawn is tiny, tiny production, so you'll have to dig. And then Hiyu, to my knowledge, really is only Winery Direct, but they do ship nationwide.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you for doing the work and, you know, overcoming your own failings and giving people something that's more regionally appropriate for this movie.
You know, I try to make it known when I know that I'm wrong.
Right.
Which isn't frequent, because I'm most frequently correct.
Hmm. Well, speaking of being wrong, we should talk about what's happening next time. In 2 weeks, 2 weeks after this episode drops, Jamie and I are kind of oscillating back and forth with this next batch of episodes. And this is one where Jamie had a wine in mind that he wanted to do. And we thought as an experiment, like we did with Widows, Jamie would give me descriptors for the wine and I would try and pick a movie to go with it. So Jamie, why don't you start with the wine?
Yes.
And then I'll tell everybody how I was wrong.
So I chose Stolpman Vineyards. This is a Syrah coming from Ballard Canyon, which is a smaller area within Santa Barbara County. And this cuvee is called La Quadrilla, which means the squad. This is a wine that was made ostensibly for and by the vineyard crew at Stolpman. And the words that I gave you to pair with were elegant, meaty, broad, and with a conscience.
Indeed. Indeed, that is what you gave me. Well, I took those words and I picked, again, we're sticking with our theme of movies from 2020. The year that wasn't, and I chose Spike Lee's fucking fantastic Vietnam War movie that's kind of about Vietnam War movies, Da Five Bloods. Ever since we made that choice and you ordered the wines and we made the announcement of what the pairings were, I have been second-guessing myself about elegant, because I think Spike Lee at times can be a very elegant and graceful filmmaker, and at other times he is like blunt as a bag of hammers, and I feel like maybe I kind of railroaded myself into this selection because I just really wanted to fucking talk about Da Five Bloods. And that is a movie that is decidedly meaty and broad and has a conscience. And I haven't watched it since the two times I watched it last summer when it came out. And I'm really looking forward to watching it again and seeing if I fucked up and picked a movie that is not even remotely elegant.
So Scotty here is lowering expectations right off the bat.
Movie's great, and I'm sure the wine will be adequate. But like, I'm just letting everybody know that we could have an interesting conversation.
I'm sure that we will.
But, like, I didn't go out of my way to pick something that's not like the movie or the descriptors that I gave you at all. I could have just said, like, oh, I'm doing counter-programming because opposites attract and I'm Jamie and this is all subjective anyway, so I can just do whatever I want and say opposites attract. Like, I'm admitting that I may have made a mistake and it is my nature to second-guess myself and be full of doubts that are crippling and exhausting. And we'll see if that manifests in this pairing.
Scott and his anxiety would like you to know that this may not be a good pairing.
But it's like lowercase a anxiety. I have like boring anxiety. I have like, you know, I'm not like nervous about going out in the world. I'm just kind of like, did I do that?
Just like kind of always a little bit nervous.
Just a little bit. But it's Spike Lee. It's on Netflix. It's a polemic. It's a war movie. It rules. It got basically totally overlooked at the Oscars because they're fucking stupid. And it has like one of the all-time great movie performances from the wildly undersung Delroy Lindo. And it's awesome.
I'm super excited to watch it. And once again, as with all of the wines for this we can call it season.
I don't call it that.
The Stoltman Vineyards La Quadrilla is available at Moore Brothers Wine Company. It is, I believe, 20-ish United States dollars. So plugs. What do you got there, Scotty? Anything?
No. You give me your plugs.
Okay.
You give me your
plugs. I have one plug. And it's, by the time this episode comes out, it'll be April 30th, I believe. And we're deep in rosé season, or like what people call rosé season. And first of all, drink rosé all the time. But second of all, if you go out shopping for wine and you see both a 2020 and a 2019 rosé, and you want to drink that tonight, you should buy the 2019. Last year's rosé is awesome. Shit does not go bad. Well, I mean, it does go bad, but it is better the year after. That's my big plug. We shouldn't be drinking all of the previous year's rosé before it's any good. Age your rosé.
So it has not matured yet in the bottle?
That's correct.
The 2020?
Yeah, I just bought a bunch of 2020 rosé for my own cellar. I will not be drinking it until next year.
Well, on my side of things, something that I watched fairly recently that I think people should check out is a completely fucking buck wild film called Jallikattu from India. It's a 2019 movie. It played at my festival back when it was still my festival. And it's like a thriller. It's in this small, remote village where there's an escaped buffalo that is just going wild and destroying everything. And all of the men of the community are like trying to hunt it down and track it down. There's a bunch of other like subplots about like commerce and betrayal and other stuff, but like it's mostly this like man versus nature, horrifying, thrilling 90-minute actioner where a fucking buffalo just destroys everything, and it ends with some of the craziest visuals I've ever seen. It's on the Amazon Prime. People should check it out. I will give you a disclaimer, as my wife described it, not inaccurately, that it is basically a feature-length film in which people scream the entire time. So like you have to brace yourself for that level of intensity, but it is a singular experience.
I'm into that.
Jallikattu on the Amazon Prime. Watch that shit loud in 4K. It is something else.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right.
We have a new review. This one just came in earlier this afternoon. And as we've promised, we're going to read all of our reviews on the air. This one came in on the platform, I believe, Deceitful Things That Were Texted to Me. And this is from dear friend of ours and longtime supporter of Jamie and I, may or may not bleep his name out. And his review of the show was, is that still a thing you guys are doing?
What a dick.
So yeah, I mean, we both know that is actually listening to the show, that he's listening to every single episode. I doubt he's watching the movies. He might be drinking the wine.
That's a hard maybe. He's also probably just drinking vodka straight because he's weird.
Yeah, straight. He's got like a little, one of those.
A beer helmet full of vodka.
Yeah, and he's just got vodka.
No, he's classier than that. He's got crystal glassware.
But anyway, so that's review of the show. Is that a thing you guys are still doing? But in all seriousness, we do have a new review. Like an actual review and not some shitty thing that a friend of ours sent to us who continues to deny listening to the show.
Even though he does.
That is right. This is from dear friend of ours and friend of the show, Ted. Ted said some lovely things, and here they are. Ted wrote, a must listen. Pairing movies with wine is a pretty novel idea, and these guys do a great job of just that. Definitely worth your time if you like either, or especially both of these things. Also, it's funny as heck, as despite how much knowledge these guys are dropping of their respective subjects, they also are just constantly getting each other's goats.
That part is very accurate.
That is extremely true. So thank you, Ted. We love you very much, Ted.
We love Ted. We stan Ted.
We love Ted. But we should be clear, he's my Ted.
Don't take possession of Ted.
I'm not possessive about a lot of things. He's my Ted.
Ted is everybody's Ted.
He's not your Ted.
He's the world's Ted.
Not after the things you did to Ted.
He's actually the universe's Ted.
As long as we can agree that he's the best Ted.
Oh, he's 100. He's the best Ted. And Teds are generally really good, except for Ted Cruz.
But yeah, if you have an extremely supportive and thoughtful review of the show, please submit it on the appropriate platform and not just as a passive-aggressive text message to me, in which you deny that you're listening to it, even though we know that you guys all are. Drop it on Apple Pods, the old Apple Podcast platform. Ratings and reviews there are extremely helpful to new shows like ours to find a new audience and to help that audience find us and check us out.
Yeah, and also we really crave validation. Give us all the positive reviews and keep the negative shit to yourself, please.
You can send the negative stuff to Jamie. I know most of the negativity is about his portion of the show. That's okay. We can all be honest about that.
So I have feelings, Scott. You know that, right? Okay, we're just going to move on. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. It is, and hopefully always will be, a pleasure podcasting, despite Scott's obtuseness. Please follow us on the social medias at Bigger Bottle Pod. Feel free to email us, biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. As Scott said, remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Always drink wine while you're watching movies. It's good for you. Thanks, everybody.
Is it good for them?
It's scientifically proven. 9 out of 10 doctors agree.
Okay. This is not an endorsement from the American Medical Association. They're not sponsors of this show.
They are not.
Nor is anyone. It's been a pleasure. This was, I think, probably a good episode. Check out Defy Bloods. Content warning, it violent as shit. And yeah, we'll see or hear you guys back in 2 weeks. Especially, we know you're listening. We love you, buddy.
Love y'all.
Good night.
And stopping the recording.
So I want to include that thing when we release the episode. I think it's funny, but I'll have to listen to it when I'm not drunk later on.